The following audio is a Sunday sermon from Red Church in Blackburn, Australia. For more information about the church and its ministry, please go to www.redchurch.org.au.
Thank you very much. Hello again. Hello. So I have a little word that I just like to share to begin with. And it's actually out of John chapter 4, and it goes like this. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. And he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well, and it was about the sixth hour. And a woman from Samaria came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." Do you remember the rest of the story? Tell the person next to you, if you don't mind. Okay, friends. So I'm taking that you know the rest of the story. And for those who don't, it'll come apparent as we go through this morning. I'd just like to read another passage that I'll come back to all of these passages later on. In Galatians 5 and verse 22, it says, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace and patience, kindness, goodness and faithfulness." Yeah. And then 1 Peter. And 1 Peter and chapter 3 and verse 15, but it says this, "But in your hearts, honour Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defence to anyone who asks you for the reason for the hope that is in you, and yet do it with gentleness and respect." Okay, so I shall come back to those. Now, you don't mind if I roam around, do you? No. So, what I want to do is I want to start talking about spouses and then move into strangers. Now, I know that must sound a little bit confusing, but then I am a Kiwi, so bear with me. Now, you may have heard this, but this research only came across my desk about a month ago. And the research basically claimed that when it comes to a successful marriage between two spouses, the success of that marriage is dependent upon only two things. And, you know, when I saw that, I was somewhat skeptical. I mean, you know, marriage at the best of times is a complex arrangement. Am I right or am I right? Yes. And I thought, you know, surely you cannot reduce complexity to just simply two items, you know. So when I think of marriage, I think of, you know, Jacob, who's referred to in that text there. And do you remember he worked for 7 years for Rachel? And he said at the end, he said, "It seemed like, you know, a couple of days." Well, I've been married 35 years and it seems like 35 years. To reduce, you know, a successful marriage to a couple of items, you know, So I read this research. And basically the research, I don't know if you've ever come across it. It's from the Gottmans. Anybody? One person at the back. So John and Julie Gottman have given decades of their life to work out what really... Are you interested? Thank you. Have worked on what really makes for a good marriage. And so what they did was they got... In 1985, they got a whole lot of couples in, and then they wired them up literally with electrodes. And they asked them three questions, you know, like, what is your marriage currently like? Are you facing a conflict? Have you got good memories? And as each and every couple responded to those questions, they monitored heart flow, heartbeat, blood flow, perspiration rate with the electrodes. And so they recorded all the results, and then they sent these couples on their way, and then after 6 years contacted them all again to see who, if any, was still together. Okay? And as a result of that kind of process, they got a list of those who had stuck together, and then they got another list of those that were still together, but really, to all intents and purposes, their marriage was not going well. It had died a natural death, even though they were still together. And secondly, those that were separated and divorced. Now, forgive me for the language. It's not mine, it's theirs. For those marriages that lasted, they called them the masters. For those marriages that did not go well, they called them the disasters. Okay, yeah. So they had masters and disasters. And then the Gottmans wanted to know, well, what was the secret for the masters? You know, what was the secret? And so what they did was that they bought 130... By the way, what do you think is the secret? Very quickly, if you like the person next to you, tell them. Okay, here we go. So they wanted to know, you know, what it was. What is this, you know, that really assisted the masters? So they got in touch with another 130 couples, and they did this retreat. And they brought these 130 couples into the retreat site, and they didn't do seminars or anything like that. What they did was that they just observed these 130 couples at retreat. And, you know, it was the kind of retreat where nothing was particularly designed. You just cooked, you fed, you went for walks. You did all manner of ordinary things. Now, while the couples were doing the ordinary, the researchers, the Gottmans and their team, just simply observed. And I think it was three quarters of the way into the retreat that John and Julie Gottman, they saw something that kind of unraveled the mystery. And what they saw was this, that during the ordinary affairs of life, the couples, the individuals within the couples, would make a connection with the other person. In other words, they would make a bid, B-I-D, forgive the accent. They would make a bid. And the bid was a bid for connection. In other words, they, you know, the hubby, for example, might say, oh, you know, Jill, look at that Hilux Surf. You know, by the way, a Hilux Surf is a four-wheel drive for those in this gathering who may not know that. And he would say, look at that amazing vehicle, you know. And of course, what they noticed, the Gottmans, was that hubby wasn't necessarily wanting to have an extended conversation about a four-wheel drive called a Hilux Surf. What husband was doing was that he was making a bid. He was putting a bid out there, and the bid was for connection. Are you with me? And so they noticed that this is what couples were doing all the time. Now, the one who puts the bid out there for connection, they'll do that on whatever topic comes to mind. The other person then has a choice. The other person can turn towards the bidder and respond and be attentive to what was raised. Or the person can turn away from the bid and the bidder. And this is what they noticed. Then, through their social research, they found out that those couples that stayed together had on average an 87% rate of turning towards each other and engaging the bid. Are you with me? And those couples that tragically fell apart, moved away from each other, even fell into hate and out of love, they only had a 33% rate of turning towards the bid. And so therefore, this couple, the Gottmans, they boiled the secret of marriage down to one thing. And the one thing was kindness. Did you like that? Isn't that interesting? I mean, kindness. In other words, what they saw was that kindness was the glue that would keep couples together. Kindness communicated to the other that they were appreciated and understood and cared for. In other words, kindness, it met the emotional needs of the other. Kindness. Now, when I reflected on that, I then began to see that in your worlds, your work world, your street world, your neighborhood world, whatever world you currently inhabit or worlds that you currently walk in, there are people who are desperate for connection. And what those people will do is that they will put out a bid and they will raise a topic. And it may seem, you know, somewhat ordinary. They are not wanting actually to have an extended conversation about that thing, but what they are desperately in need of is connecting with you. And at that point, you and I, we face a choice. Do we turn towards the bid? In other words, extend kindness. Or do we move away from the bidder? Are you with me now? So, let me give you an example. I'll give you some examples of this. I'll never forget that I was in a supermarket, as you are. And I was in the supermarket and I getting my tray of food or my, you know, basket of food. And as I was getting closer to the counter, I heard this voice behind me say, "Hi, Mick." Someone actually, I was speaking recently somewhere and they said, "Rhys Darby." Oh, that went down well. anyway, so I said, she said to me, "Oh, hi, Mick. Flight of the Conchords, Rhys Darby." Thank you. So she said, "Hi, Mick." And I turned around and I said to her, "Do I know you?" And she said, "No, you don't know me. But I have heard you speak on one occasion." And so to all intents and purposes, we were strangers one to the other. So we did the na-na-na-na thing. You know, we chatted away, na-na-na-na. And then we both got close to our respective counters. And she was in a wheelchair. So she rolled through her counter and I said goodbye. And then several minutes later, I went through my counter. And then I came outside and she was waiting for me. And I said, "Oh, hi." And she said, "Hi." And she said, "Oh, Mick, can we go sit somewhere and have a chat?" And I said, "Fine, you've got your chair." You know, I could tell she had a wicked sense of humour. You know, I mean, she was effing all over the place and assing all over the place and... you know what I mean by that. And I could tell she was a wicked lady, you know. And a good, you know what I mean by that too, don't you? Boy, I'm getting lost in translation this morning. And then, so we went to a cafe down the road and we sat down to talk. I didn't know her, she didn't know me really. And for about an hour, she just babbled away. You know, but I knew what was going down at this point. She was babbling to bomb. Because really what she was wanting to do was desperately trying to make connection. She was putting out not just one bid, but a million. And at that point, I kept saying to myself, you know, the self-talk, Turn towards the bitter. You know, and that last, so we indulged, I indulged in an hour of small talk. And you know, I'll quote Eugene Peterson here, I don't know if you've read him, but you know, he talks in the language of, you know, that we must immerse ourselves, be attentive, be appreciative of the, he calls it the textual circumstances of other people's lives, their ordinary. Do you like that? In other words, do the small talk. And as other people see us do the small talk, oh, they gravitate towards us. But if they see us dazing and glazing over when they do small talk, they begin to make a hasty retreat. Yes? So I gravitated towards her. I moved towards her. I turned towards the bitter. After an hour, she said, "Oh, Mick, are you religious?" And maybe she picked that up. I don't know. And I said, "Oh, it all depends what you mean by that word. But if we think of the best in that word, yeah, maybe I could be." And she said, "So you're sort of a Christian or something?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll go with that." And then she said, "Well, I have been in this wheelchair all my life." And I said, "Oh, how long is that?" And she said, 38 years. And she said, she said to me, "Well, so how can God be real given that fact?" And I said to her, "Well, I'm real." You know, I didn't feel as though I had to go into the big defense thing at that point. So I just simply said to her, "I'm real. And would you like to have a coffee next week with me in the same place?" And she said, "Yeah." But what amazed me, and I've been amazed ever since and even before, was that out there, it is absolutely bizarre, but utterly refreshing. Because what people want to do is they desperately want to talk about their major issues with a stranger. They do, because they are tired of the voices in their own micro worlds, and they are wanting to hear something different. In other words, they are wanting to place their difficult issues in the hands of a stranger. Mom, I like that. And it's true. So she did that with me. She just put her difficult issues in my hands, the hands of a stranger. So I said to her, "Well, would you like to have a coffee next week?" And she did. We had coffees every single week for 2 years. After 2 years, she said to me, she said, "So Mick, what does it mean to become and to be a Christian?" So that was 2 years later. And so I took her through something that I've worked up myself. I was hoping to stay tonight, and I would have actually done it tonight, but I got to catch this jolly plane. So maybe another time. But I took her through something that I've developed, and I continued to have coffees with her every week for another 2 years. Now you can do this. What do you think? People, I just need you to be a slightly more Pentecostal. Thank you. So, I mean, here in Melbourne, I used to live, you may have heard the story, it's worth telling 100 times. Here in Melbourne, there was this little girl who was brought up. She was born with a cleft palate. Have you told this story here? Born, and her name was Jenny. Have you heard this? Born with a cleft palate. And when she got to the age of 5, her parents, you know, they loved her dearly, and they thought, "We'll get her to have an operation to try and, you know." And, you know, most cleft palate operations are just a success. But this, for whatever reason, it just did not come off. And so she ended up, poor little Jenny, with, you know, even a more grotesque kind of scarring on her face. And then she went to school. And, of course, she just, because of this thing, she just involuntarily salivated. And, you know, you can imagine what happened as a little girl at school. She came in for so much teasing. And so she had scars on her face and scars on her spirit, as it were. And then she grew up, and then her parents, you know, they fell apart. So maybe there wasn't enough of that turning towards the bitter. I don't know. But they fell apart and finally got divorced. And that kind of crisis was enough to awaken in Jenny a kind of a search for that which is good and true and right. And so she went on this kind of spiritual journey search, and it eventually led for her towards Christ. And she became a Christ follower. And she started going to a church here in Melbourne. And then there was just this one particular week, you know, it was her 21st birthday. And she waited for the gift of her father and the gift of a 21st present, and neither turned up. And then the following Sunday, you know, she went to church. And she said to her mum, look, I'm just going to go to just around the, I'll walk tonight. So she walked to church that night, and then on the way home, she walked home, of course. And then as she was walking home, a car pulled up to the sidewalk, and two leather-clad men jumped out of this car, grabbed her, took her to a place that she didn't want to go to, and did things to her body that shouldn't be done to anybody. Now, before the rape, Jenny and her friends had decided to go to this big conference here in Melbourne. But after the rape, do you think that Jenny wanted to go? No way. But her friends kept, you know, pestering her. Come on, come on, Jen. Come on, come on. This will be good for you. This will be good for you. And finally, she was so persuaded. And so she and her friends rocked up to this big gathering here in Melbourne. And they rocked up so late, they joined all the other latecomers. All the latecomers, they blocked the main entrance point so that the great guest speaker couldn't come down the aisle and get to the platform. So what the officials did was that they pushed all the latecomers aside, and a human corridor was formed. And Jenny was pushed into the human corridor. And then the great guest speaker and all the entourage, they were coming down, and then this great guest speaker saw Jenny, didn't know Jenny at all. They were strangers one to the other. And this great guest speaker walked up to Jenny and just said to Jenny, I can see you are in much pain. And of course, tears began to roll down Jenny's cheeks at that point. And then the great guest speaker said, would you like to come and sit with me on the platform? Would you like to come? And so with that, you know, I mean, by this time, she was gulping back the tears. Jenny, she took the hands of Desmond Tutu. Desmond Tutu, the great activist who worked alongside Mandela in the apartheid era of South Africa. She took the hand of this crazy little man, Desmond Tutu, and she walked with him and sat with him for the rest of the night on the platform. And that was the beginning of her healing. Are you getting this? The stranger love. And how you can go beyond your current circles. I mean, someone once did that to me. And when I was in my last year, I don't know how many more minutes I've got. Give me your time. When I was in my last year of school, do you mind if I just close with a few little stories? Do you mind? When I was in my last year of school, there was no one at home one night, and I got so upset by this. I thought, what on earth is going on? And I waited to 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and there was no one. And so I thought, stuff it. So I went to my bedroom and I pulled back the cover off my bed, and as I did, a little white envelope fell to the floor, and it was a letter from my mother. And she said, Dear Michael, you know, I got mickified here in Australia. And it was from my mother, and she said, look, my marriage to, you know, your father, my husband, is now over. So maybe they weren't connecting to each other. And so she said, your twin sister is away, your younger brother is gone somewhere else, your dad has taken off, and I've had to just retreat, you're home alone. And in a sense, that was my awakening. And I then, like never before, started to think in terms of what is right, what is good, what is true. So I went on a search for what is right, good, and true, and went on the search because I didn't come from a Christian background whatsoever. And so this search took me into all manner of things. And I did Eastern mysticism. I did the occult. I did, as a lot of us did in those good days. And I became a user of Class A drugs and a dealer of Class A and so forth and so on. And to cut a very long story short, I ended up in the city of Christchurch, which is in the South Island. And this is way before the earthquakes have absolutely ravaged that city. And I used to there, you know, I was just barefooted and long matted hair, natural dreads, not the commercial ones today. And then I had the straggly beard and clothes that were filthy as they could walk without me being in them. And I just used to rock up to the main cathedral square that was the main centre in the city. And at lunchtime, and there was a gathering crowd, and they all came to watch the shootout at the OK Corral, as it were, because a big, tall, hooded, black, cloaked creature, you know, dressed up like a wizard, pre-Harry Potter, would just be there, you know, trying to hold the gathering crowd, you know, sort of spellbound with his incantations on life. And then as he was raving and ranting, a little short white fella with a big black Bible would also, 3 meters apart, start talking at the same time. Then they would turn on each other. And, you know, at that time, and I don't think much has changed, I thought this has got to be the only entertainment in Christchurch. So I turned up and just watched this, and then I became part of the freak show, which is you're probably thinking, yes, we can imagine that. And so I became a part of this freak show, and there was that wizard and that short white fellow with a big black Bible, and then me, you know, just kind of like a dead dog. And I did look like a dead dog. I smelt like a dead dog. And then one day, a friend of the short white fella with a big black Bible came up to me, didn't know each other. We were complete strangers. And he says, oh, hi. I say, hi. And then he says, where do you live? And I said, anywhere. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, anywhere. And he just said, what do you mean? I thought, how thick can these Christians be? So I said, anywhere, you know, under bridges, secondhand car lots, you know, gate crash with friends, I'll just sleep anywhere. He said, anywhere. So anyway, a couple of weeks later, and he came back and he said, do you mean anywhere? And I thought, goodness me. So at that point, he said, and then he left. And then several months later, he came back and he said, come with me. So I hopped in his car. I wasn't into anything. Hopped into his car and he took me for a drive and lasted 10 minutes. He got out of the car and he said, come with me. And he walked down an alleyway and he said, come with me. And walked into a house and he said, come with me. And he walked down the corridor and he said, come with me. And he walked through the kitchen and he said, come with me. And then he walked, you know, into his bedroom and he said, come with me. Now, I was a bit worried at that point. Then he closed the door and I'm thinking, what next? And then he went straight to the wardrobe. And he opened the wardrobe and there were all these jackets and coats. And I thought, Narnia. And you know, just the drugs were still swimming in there. And then he got a suitcase down and he unzipped the suitcase and he put some clothes in. Then he zipped up the suitcase and he went to the door and he opened the door and he said, see ya. And I said, what? And he said, see ya. And I said, what? And he said, you can have this bedroom and it's all yours. I've had the rent paid up for months in advance, and everything now that is in this room is yours. And he left. I never saw him again. And I looked around. I thought, not bad. And then next to the bed was a coffee table with a Bible on it. And that was really the first time that I had bumped into the book. And I thought, who's not to want to read it after an incredible demonstration of love from a stranger? And you know, I look at myself now in the mirror and I go, not bad. Do you know, I am now quite a beautiful person. thank you. It's good that it was from a guy. And I thought, you know, not bad. And I would not be the beautiful person that I am today if it wasn't but for a stranger. To finish, we have three children, and our eldest, when she was here in Melbourne, she flipped and she spiraled down into a big dark hole. And she then put us through hell for 16 years. And she got involved in lock-up material. When we left Melbourne, got back to New Zealand, she got involved in the heavy gang scene. She took up relationships, and I've got her permission to say all of this, by the way, but she got involved in guys who were physically abusive. And these were long-term relationships. And then she got herself involved in heavy, she became an addict. It was so bad that she had to flee New Zealand because of the police. And like, you know, all criminals, where did she come? To Australia. I just couldn't resist that. So she came over here. She came to Australia. And she got involved in all various scenes here. But do you know what happened here? There were some dear Christians here who she did not know at all. Complete strangers to her. And for however this works, these Australian Christians heard a whisper in the heart of their imagination. Go talk to that girl over there on the train. Go up to that girl over there who's standing in the corner. Go up to, and this is her each and every time, and these Australian Christians, in a inoffensive, non-confrontational way, walked up to her time and time and time again. And you should see my eldest daughter now. She's about 34 or something like that. So I turned 60 this year. But she's about 34, I think, 33. And she's the most radiant, vibrant, vital Christian. She works with women that none of us could really work with. Honestly, they are tough bitches. No, they're real TB. These are women who, you know, these are, and that wasn't a derogatory statement, by the way. That was a sociological statement. These are hard ladies. I've seen them. Real TBs. And she's now working them with a big heart. And what made the difference? And she's now this vibrant Christian, you know, beautiful lady, young lady. And what made the big difference? Australian Christians who had the courage and the kindness to walk towards a stranger. So I'm indebted to this country. It helped rescue my daughter. So in Galatians 5:22, it says the fruit of the Spirit is kindness. Where you turn towards the people out there who are putting out a bid. And you turn towards them. And that word kindness carries the idea of a kind of a gentleness. And then in 1 Peter 3:15, it talks about, you know, going to people, but again, with kindness. And, you know, that word kindness in 1 Peter 3:15 carries the idea of holding your power. In other words, not being all over people,
But actually doing it in a very careful, measured, but gracious way. And Dallas Willard calls all of that kindness the allure of gentleness. That's what I felt to share. And come on, people. Let's turn towards the bidders, the people who are desperately wanting to connect, and do it with kindness. And this is all from a mad Kiwi. God bless you.
Thank you, Mick. There's a lot of stories between the lines there, particularly of his own story and his own testimony. Thank you so much. We are going to enter into a time of communion. Communion is that banquet. It's a foretaste of what is to come in that great kingdom when everything will be reconciled and everything made right. This is Jesus' bid to you each week. That whatever is going on, wherever you are lonely, wherever you feel alienated, wherever you feel forgotten, discouraged, wherever you feel hopeful, this is him wanting to restore and give you his life. Here at Red, we come forward. There's some at the back as well. And we take of the juice or the wine and then dip the bread in and have that moment with our Saviour alone but together. But in leading into that, just wanting to not remotely detract from what Mick has said, but to encourage us with this call to communion, I just want to tell a story that Jesus says in Luke 14. And he says, when you're invited by someone to a wedding banquet, do not recline at the best place because a more distinguished person than you may have been invited by your host. The one who invited both of you may come and say to you, give your place to this man. And then in humiliation, you will proceed to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and recline in the lowest place so that when the one who invited you comes, he will say to you, friend, move higher. You will then be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. So, when you give a lunch or a dinner, don't invite your friends and your brothers and your relatives or your rich neighbors because they might invite you back and you'll be repaid. Instead, when you host a banquet, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. And you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Jesus then goes on to tell a story of his great banquet that he wants to give. And he invites all these wonderful people, but they're full of excuses. Go, oh, sorry, I've just gotten married. Or sorry, I've just taken up a job. Or sorry, I've just got to go bury my father. Or sorry, I'm a bit too busy maybe next week. Sometimes we Christians are so fat on the feast that we miss out on the best feast of all. And it's in our brokenness, our humiliation, our hurt, our discouragement, our sickness, our own sense of not being known and being the stranger that we are once again reminded of our need for Jesus. And so as we come forward for communion, may you consider his bid towards you, and may his act of love and kindness and bid towards you beckon you towards the stranger in our midst here, the stranger in your midst at work, in your street, in our neighbourhood. Come forward as you're ready.